please.
Right. Thank you very much, Hans-Peter. So good morning, everyone. So it's a real pleasure for me to be here. It's my first time at in Santa Barbara, actually. So I actually realized that I give a talk on May 1st. I mean, I should be in France demonstrating in the streets. I mean, usually you don't work this particular day. But so first, I really would like to thank the organizers for the invitation here. It's really a pleasure and to be here and to discuss with and interact with many of you. So technically speaking, the talk, what I'm going to talk about is work done at the Institut d'Optique, which is not really in Paris, actually, despite this Eiffel Tower, but it's south of Paris, 20 kilometers south. And before I dive too much into the topic, here is the picture of our group. So all those people contributed to what I'm going to talk about today. And I really would like to mention the fact that now that we're doing many body physics, I mean, most of us are from the AMO community, so really kind of clueless about many bodies. So we receive a lot of theory support. And for what I'm going to present today, it's essentially the theory support from the chair of this session. So I will also report on his work, basically. And So the kind of many-body physics I'm going to talk about is very specific. It's going to be connected to spin models. So and even a simple spin model, so it's arrays of random or not random, actually, spin 1/2 that are pinned in space, that's what we assume, and somehow we make them interact via Ising type of interaction or Heisenberg type of interaction. You will see a bit more in a minute. But typically, this kind of spin Hamiltonian, they are introduced in different contexts. They are, of course, introduced in the context of quantum magnetism, and if you understand how the electronic spin interact, you may understand bulk magnetism, for example. And they're also used, and that's mainly what I'm going to focus about, in the context of transport. So transport of excitation through a chain, or for example, when you look at excitation in light scattering. So despite the fact that those models are very well known, of course, and have been written a long time ago, there are lots of open questions, and especially it's hard to calculate the dynamics of those models, especially if it's an open problem, meaning connected to an environment. And some of the questions that also we can study now is to the role of topology in those spin models, the role of disorders, the role of dissipation, obviously. And so the great thing that happened over the last few decades is the fact that now we've got those artificial systems onto which that we can use in order to revisit some of these problems or to explore them a bit more. So I don't need to say more about what are those artificial quantum systems. So we've heard a lot since the beginning of the talk. I mean, quantum circuit, ions, atoms, photons. And the one that I'm going to present is one which is based on this thing doesn't work any longer, it's all right. And an array of individual atoms that are trapped in optical tweezers. So this is our platform. So this is basically an ensemble, a fluorescence image. It's a single-shot fluorescence image of individual atoms, each of these atoms being trapped in an optical tweezer. So that's a laser beam, which is very tightly focused. And here, basically, there is only one atom in this trap. So as you can see, we can arrange them in many different geometries. These geometries can be selected at will, basically, those kind of lines, the square kind of hexagon, a honeycomb type of structure, Kagome. And the basic idea is that the typical distance between the atoms are a few micrometers and that you can produce any geometry in two dimensions. We can also produce 3D structures. So this is an example also of 3D structure we can produce with this array of tweezers, so those laser beams. So these are average images of fluorescence of atoms. So those are really atoms assembled in 3D in space and reconstructed plane by plane. The only thing here is that I made you believe that all the traps are filled, which is not the case. If we take a single shot image, about half the traps would be empty. Okay, so those here are just average images of the fluorescence. And so that's where we can produce this kind of Möbius strip, some kind of structure, and this probably useless for physics, but at least cool to put on a wish card or whatever, this Eiffel Tower. So this kind of platform, actually, so we started to develop that more than 10 years ago now, and there are really many people who are using that, and I'm not even citing all of them now, because there are just a very large community. So the typical distance between the atoms in this array is on the order of a few micrometers. So, I mean, of course, they do not interact if they are in their electronic ground state. So the way for us to make them interact, despite the fact they are so far away, is to promote them to Rydberg states. So those Rydberg states are highly excited states, high principal quantum number. Classically, this is this image of the electron spiraling very far from the nucleus. And the consequence of this is twofold, is the fact that they have a long lifetime, typically 100 microseconds. And second, more important even, the fact that they develop very large dipole moments. So therefore, it will, I mean, two atoms will interact very strongly via the dipole-dipole interaction. And kind of the number to remember is the fact that if two atoms are separated by about 10 micrometers, they would interact with an interaction strength which is in the megahertz range. So any dynamics which is driven by the interaction will occur on a sub-microsecond timescale. Okay, so the kind of interactions that can occur naturally between two Rydberg atoms are essentially can be classified in two of them. So there is the van der Waals interaction, which is the natural interaction that occurs when you try to place the two atoms in the same Rydberg state. Okay, so in this case, I mean, the doubly excited state, so basically the fact that you place two atoms in the same Rydberg state, would be shifted by an amount which is C6 over R6. And so from the point of view of the spin models, this implements naturally an Ising model. Okay, and I'm not going to discuss that during this talk. I'm going more to focus on the second type of interaction here, which is the resonant dipole-dipole interaction. So there, the two states are not the same state. So one atom is promoted into one Rydberg state, the other one is promoted to another Rydberg state that are connected, as I will show you in a minute. So once again, in the talk of Igor just after me, you will see application of the Ising-like model in the dissipative context. And so here, I will really focus on this 1 over R3 resonant dipole-dipole interaction. So the kind of topic that, so the outline of the talk, I would like to cover basically two topics. I would just like to illustrate how you can use the resonant dipole-dipole interaction in order to implement artificial topological matter that we can study. So in a sense, this would be the coherent simulation of many body problem. And then I will touch, and I don't know how much time I will have really, but on the problem of looking at this resonant dipole-dipole interaction from the point of view of quantum optics more, and that would be connected to the dissipative and collective dissipation in this system. So let's start with this artificial topological matter. So I should point out once again, because it was really crucial for us, the input of Franz-Peter Büchler and his group. I mean, all the concepts are actually from him and not from us. And the contribution will become clear as I go on. So once again, the kind of atomic structure we're using, so we use rubidium atoms. They are trapped in those tweezers. We promote those rubidium atoms to a given Rydberg state, so this will be the state 60s 1/2, doesn't really matter, so we use two photon excitation. This is a real experiment, so basically you've got some finite probability to achieve everything, so we can discuss a bit more at the end of the talk whether this is dissipation or something else. Clearly, it means that we've got errors in these things. And so for now on, you can completely forget about all this plumbing, basically, and we're going to focus only on two different Rydberg states, so one which is a 60s state, the other one a 60p state. And as usual, I will map that onto a spin 1/2 system, so this will be the spin down, this will be the spin up. So, of course, they are connected by a very strong dipole matrix element, so therefore it's easy to drive microwave rotation on this. So this is an example of a Rabi oscillation between those two states that you see as hardly any damping. Actually, it has a finite contrast, but hardly any damping over time scale, which are several microseconds. So from the point of view of the interaction, what happens? I mean, if we take two of those atoms and if we consider the imbalance situation where one atom is in spin up, the other one in spin down, what the resonant dipole-dipole interaction can do is that it can flip-flop the state of those two atoms. So one atom would go down, so would get excited, so the spin flips, while the other one goes up. And this naturally implements this XY model in the language of a spin model, which is the sigma plus sigma minus type of interactions. Okay, so to start with, I mean, we can observe this kind of flip-flop interaction in a coherent way by preparing two atoms, one in spin up, the other one in spin down, and letting that evolve as a function of time. So here, this is an example where the atoms are actually very far from each other, in 30 micrometers. And over a time scale, which is on a fraction of microsecond, you do see that indeed they exchange their state as a function of time. So that's the probability that the first atom is in spin up, and that's the probability that the second atom is in spin up. And as you see, indeed, they exchange coherently, almost no damping again, for this at a frequency which is given by the resonant, the strength of the resonant dipole interaction. So this is a dipolar interaction, so it means that it's anisotropic in space as well. So with respect to a quantization axis, and we could discuss what this means exactly, if the internuclear axis is not exactly aligned with this, you would see that the C3 coefficient would be, as we learn in ENM, actually a 1 minus 3 cosine square theta, so the angle depends whether the two spins are like this or whether they're like that. And this is the measurement of, in a polar coordinate, of the strength of the interaction, so we varied the angle, basically, and measure the frequency of this. In a polar coordinate, and as you see, I mean, it fits well with the expected curve, which is this one. Okay, so very important for what I'm going to discuss in a minute, there is a particular magic angle at which the dipole-dipole interaction is zero, and this angle is around 55 degrees. So if you set them this way with respect to a quantization axis, basically they do not interact. So now, this kind of spin exchange model can be thought in a different, or converted in a different language, which is the language of a spin excitation, which is like a particle which hops from one side to another one. So actually, it's a two-body problem, but I map it onto a single particle problem where one particle would be located on site A and moves onto site B. So basically, a particle would be spin up, and the spin down would be kind of a background of no particle in the system. Okay, so I will use this mapping in order to implement a particular instance of a topological model, which is the Sue-Schrieffer-Eger model. So Eger is actually a permanent staff member here in the chemistry department. He received a Nobel Prize in chemistry to have introduced this model and other things, of course, which was the explanation of the conductivity of organic polymers. So this is the kind of a seminal paper. So the basic idea is that if you look at this chain of polyacetylene and you dope that, I mean, there is an extraordinary conductivity of this. Okay, so people have looked at that a lot, obviously, over the years. And so the thing that people have realized is that now it can also be considered as one of the simplest model featuring topological properties. So I'm going to try to describe them in a minute. And so the goal for us in the lab is to engineer this model and trying to explore the role of various things that we took for granted. For example, the role of symmetries in this, the role of interactions between the particles in the system. And this is what I'm going to try to explain you in a minute. So once again, the kind of system we want to describe is this. So the approach that Eger, Sue, and Schrieffer took was to use a tight binding model. So basically, they identified two sublattices with an alternance of strong and weak bounds. So they work in this kind of dimerized limit. Well, basically, you've got strong bounds, weak bounds, and alternance of all this. So, and the kind of important feature of this SSH model, which I will come back on to later, is the fact that there is some kind of underlying symmetry, which is the fact that if you do not have any coupling between sites within one of these subchains, it turns out then that the spectrum in energy is symmetric with respect to zero, okay, which I'm going to illustrate in a minute. So let's take now a finer chain, and let's assume first that I end this finer chain by the strongest link. Okay, so I mean you can calculate the energy spectrum; it's even analytical for this. And basically, what you find that there are two bands. There is a gap on the order of the strongest link J, and the width of the band is on the order of the weakest link J prime. So now I have considered one particular example, so where basically I end on the strong link, but of course I could also end on the weakest link, so basically I invert this. And if we do that, what happens is that you will see within the gap the appearance of two states at zero energy, which correspond to the state that are essentially localized on the edge of this chain. Okay, so this actually, these two things, so basically these two configurations here corresponds to two different topology of the problem, and you cannot move and switch from one to another without closing the gap. Okay, so if you vary J over J prime, you need to close the gap to basically take the zero energy state here and bring them in the bulk. So this is an example of the topological protection, because it means that whatever the value of g over j prime, provided the fact that you are here, you will always have zero energy for those two states, even if you've got fluctuations in the parameters. So this is one of the simplest examples also of this bulk edge correspondence, which is if you want to identify topological properties in the bulk, you just look at what happens on the edge. So here the edge is the simplest you can imagine. Those are just two atoms. So we want to implement that in the lab. So we're going to use this mapping onto the spin excitation, onto a hopping of one particle from one side to another one. So the thing we also want to implement is this idea of the chiral symmetry, which makes the spectrum symmetric with respect to zero. So this is where it was important, and that was the idea of Hans Peter actually, to use the fact that there is a magic angle here. Because now we can align two chains, the two subchains, at this magic angle in such a way that we completely cancel the interaction within a subchain. Okay? But now what we can also do is just by flipping one atom from one position to another, you can switch from the normal to the topological configuration. Okay? So in this way, with the same setup, you can explore the two configurations. So let's try to see whether we have at least implemented the essential feature of this SSH model. So what we're going to do is we're going to do microwave spectroscopy of this system, but working for the moment in the single particle limit, which is to say that starting from what is called a vacuum, so basically all the spin downs, which means all the atoms prepared in the 60S state, we're going to apply a microwave and see where we start to excite one atom, so to put one excitation in the system. And so we've done that first in the case of the normal chain. So what we see here is the number of sites. This is the detuning of the microwave, so the frequency of the microwave. And the third dimension, the color map, basically, corresponds to the probability to having excited one excitation in the system. So what we see is that indeed we can access this kind of lower band, and then there is no state any longer. In principle, we should have this higher band here, but for overlap integrals reasons, so they are actually very small. But the thing which should be contrasted with is the fact that now if we work in the topological configuration, we do see at zero energy appearing those states that are essentially localized on the edge. Okay, so this is basically the difference between the existence of the edge states or no edge state, depending whether you work in the normal or topological configuration. So it seems that indeed we have implemented some kind of feature of this chiral symmetry, so the fact that this J second is zero, and the spectrum is then symmetric with respect to zero. And so I should say that, of course, we are far from being the only one having done that. Actually, there is a vast literature of implementation of this. So I will just briefly show you a few of them here, so for the most recent, actually. So in ultra-cold atoms in optical lattices, so in the group of Bloch in principle, in particular at Max Planck, people have done very nice experiments by using the Bragg diffraction as well of matter waves, so in the group of Weiss and Gadway in the US. And there are some other type of implications, of implementation, sorry, with photonic device in the group of Jacqueline Bloch in particular in France. And the thing which is kind of striking is that you can also implement all these features of the topology just using classical oscillators, which is telling you that the topology has nothing to do with quantum. And so basically, actually, the kind of thing we want to explore is actually the quantum part, so to say, the interplay between the topology and the interactions between the quasi-particle, which are my spin excitations. So now I will use another mapping again, and I will say that despite the fact that initially this SSH model was introduced for non-interacting fermions, here what we have on the experiment is a spin system, and this spin system can be mapped on two bosons. So basically, I could decide that now spin down is zero particles, spin up is one particle, I replace the sigma plus by B-Dagger type of operator. And the thing which is nice with this spin system is that they feature natural interactions. The interaction is very specific. This is a hardcore type of interaction, which comes from the fact that, for example, this process where you would have two spin up excitation and one spin down in the middle, the fact that this would hop here or here is prevented. So basically, it takes an infinite amount of energy to put two excitations on the same atom because you do not have any state available here. So this is basically writing the soft core interaction, but in the limit where u goes to infinity. And so at the end of the day, the kind of Hamiltonian that describes that in second quantization is this B dagger B plus B B dagger with the hardcore constraint, which is implemented by in the fact that the square of the creation has to be zero. Okay, so this Hamiltonian, of course, we will operate on small number of atoms, and typically we have like 8 or 7 dimers, so about 14 atoms, so we can almost diagonalize this. So what I'm going to show you here is the spectrum of energy in energy, so that we have calculated of this. So as a function, sorry, of the number of excitation we place in the system. So initially we've got no excitation, so zero energy. Now if we place one excitation in the system, you recognize exactly the spectrum that I described so far. So with this gap, the existence of two H state in the topological phase. And now, of course, we can increase the number of excitation in the problem. So we add them one by one until we reach almost half filling. So almost half filling means that at some point we will have this state here, which corresponds to the bulk, which is half filled, and no excitation on the edge. But we can also add one more excitation, and I again have this state here, where now one of the two edge, so the bulk is left unchanged basically, and I have one of the two edge states which are empty, or I can do the same by adding an extra excitation, and now I fill the two edge state. Okay, and what you can see here is that basically those two states, and that's a feature that I'm not going to describe too much, but are degenerating energy. Okay, so that's one defining properties of these those states, is that you've got three degenerate ground state, four-fold degenerate ground state, because this central one is actually two-fold degenerate. You can have either the left or the right state, which is filled. And then there is an excitation gap here. That's also what we see from this diagonalization. And then, of course, we can again add more and more excitation, and there is some kind of particle hole symmetry in the problem. It's the same to exchange spin up with spin down. Okay, so now in the lab we want to prepare this ground state. So the way we do it is just by an adiabatic sweep of a microwave. So basically we couple and we add one by one the excitation in the system, just by sweeping the frequency and the detuning of a microwave pulse. And so in this way, we can adiabatically prepare the ground state, where basically here there is no edge state excited. So basically we only have the bulk, which is half filled. So, I mean, we have characterized, and there is a lot that we could say about that, but one very important thing that I want to show you is to come back to this chiral symmetry that I discussed, and that was kind of an essential feature of the SSH model for the single particle case. So basically the idea, I remind you, is that, I mean, we wanted to implement the fact that there is no coupling inside the subchain, but now we're going to break on purpose this. And the way to do it experimentally is actually fairly easy. You just take one atom and do not put it at the magic angle here, in such a way that you introduce a coupling between the H state here and this kind of bulk. So if you do that and you do the microwave spectroscopy that I showed you before, so basically the 2H state should not be at zero energy any longer. So we violated this chiral symmetry. And indeed, when we do the measurement of where are the left and right state, the left is essentially unchanged, and the right state is shifted in energy. So indeed, breaking this chiral symmetry, so this J second equals zero, lifts the degeneracy at the single particle level. Now we're going to do the very same experiment, starting from the many-body ground state, where basically the bulk is half-filled, but you do not have any state, any particles or population in any of the 2H state. And we again do the microwave spectroscopy to see at which energy we add one particle in the system. In the single particle case, if we do that, we shift. In the many particle case, when we start from this many-body state, what we find experimentally is that those H states are degenerate again. Okay, so there is some kind of difference between the many-body state and the single particle spectrum. So basically, we cannot understand this many-body degeneracy in the only referring to the single particle spectrum. So in quantum physics, quite often, when you've got a degeneracy in the spectrum, there is some kind of underlying symmetry. And indeed, this is what we have. And once again, I'm going to only flash a few ideas here, is that indeed in the many-body state, there are two degeneracies here. And the degeneracies are the two symmetries. You have the particle hole symmetry, and you've got the conservation of the number of particles, which is ensured by this B dagger B type of structure. And the consequence of that is that you can classify the topological matter can be classified in some ways according to the type of symmetries that act on the Hamiltonian. And it turns out that if you do that, you access what is called a symmetry protected topological phase. So you just classify those phases according to the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and the basic idea is that you cannot vary any parameter in the Hamiltonian that would move from one phase to another without closing the gap or without breaking the symmetry. And so basically, the kind of thing that we have done, so that was something introduced not that long ago, actually, by Polman, is that, and later on, people kind of classify that, so this is kind of the Mendeleev table, if you wish, of all the phases that you can get according to the symmetries. So I'm only flashing that to tell you that what we've done experimentally is just to put one dot, basically, in this table. So we have realized this particular instance of a topological symmetry-protected topological phase, which in one dimension turns out to be the only type of topological order you can prepare. I mean, you can prepare many of different phases, but this is the only, the SPT, these symmetry-protected topological phases, are the only phases that you can order, that you can get in 1D. And so what we are working on now, again, together with Hans Peter, is to try to explore the topology now in two dimensions, because we have a two-dimensional structure. So trying to see some kind of edge state. So this is theory here. And the idea would be to try to explore the function, the fractional quantum Hall effects for bosons in this case, which people would consider are the true topological order, which you do not have in 1D, but you could have in two dimensions. Okay. So in the last 5 minutes, and I'm going to be kind of brief on this, I would like to put this kind of resonant dipole-dipole interaction into a larger perspective, trying to remember you that basically we can understand it almost classically. So the basic idea is that classically, if you've got two dipoles, and those dipoles are driven, so they oscillate at the frequency omega, of course they can interact. So they can do two things. They can either radiate at a rate which is basically gamma, which you can calculate from ENM, but they can also interact because the field scattered by the first dipole interacts with the second dipole, which is driven. So, I mean, we learned from ENM how to calculate these things, and we've got this rather complicated formula, which shows that the dipole-dipole interactions between those two induced dipoles has several terms. Long-term, long-distance terms, 1 over r, short near-field terms, 1 over r cubed, and there is some intermediate terms, 1 over r squared. So this is kind of a complicated thing. Now, if you map that onto this language of spin exchange, basically, this is, again, what I've described earlier. So this is the very same interaction, which I described classically here, but now I describe it quantum mechanically. And the VDD that you have to put in this sigma plus sigma minus is actually, in some approximation, this complicated expression. I mean, of course, this is not the expression I showed you in the case of Rydberg, so what's the difference between that? I will show you in a minute. So what this dipole-dipole interaction leads to is the existence of several modes, what are called the superradiant mode and the subradiant mode. So basically, this corresponds classically to the two dipoles oscillating in phase or in phase opposition. So one has at a very close distance scattering rate, which is almost zero because there is a destructive interference between the two dipoles, and it would be twice in the case of the superradiant mode. So what is the link between that and what I told you before in the case of the Rydberg? Well, I mean, let's look at this complicated expression. You see that there is kind of a cutoff distance, basically, which is set by the inverse of the wavelength of the transmission, of the transition, so 1 over k. So far, we've worked with two atoms separated by a few micrometers, and we work on the Rydberg transition. So basically, if you work in this kind of near-field thing here, you can completely ignore all the k factors, if you wish. And we work with only the 1 over r cubed term. And in this case, the dissipation, which comes from the fact that you've got a complex number here, completely drops out. So this is the regime of the coherent excitation, or the coherent spin dynamics and coherent interaction. Now, if, on the other hand, we work in a regime where kr, so the distance between the atoms with respect to the inverse wavelength, is on the order of 1, then this will lead to dissipative spin models. Okay, so the thing is that if we use the very same atom, we have access to both regimes, because, I mean, so far I've discussed about the Rydberg. So the Rydberg separated by a few micrometers in distance. The typical spectrum of energy difference between two nearby Rydberg states is in the gigahertz regime, so which is a wavelength, a 1 over k, on the order of a few centimeters. So we are naturally, in the case of the Rydberg, in this coherent part where you do not need to worry about the coherent dissipation associated to this dipole-dipole interaction. But now, of course, you may want to work on the low-lying lines, in which case the typical distance is less than a micrometer. And in this case, you would lead immediately to this dissipative spin model. But be careful, the dissipation is intrinsic to the system. And this is not something you don't want. This is an asset of the system. And actually, Igor has done a lot of work on this, as many other people. And so, as I'm getting short in time, the basic idea that we looked at this in the context of light scattering. Because once again, this light scattering problem can be cast into this dissipative spin model just by the fact that at some point one atom is going to be excited when you shine the light. But now it has two options. It can either release the energy in free space, as it would if it were in really not surrounded by any atoms, or it can also exchange its energy at a rate which is given by this dipole-dipole interaction. So there is an extra decay channel for the atoms, which means that if the sample is dense enough, then the scattering becomes collective in nature. You cannot ignore the fact that all the atoms participate in the same way. Okay, so let me just tell you so that we've studied that experimentally, but so the kind of experiment that we've done so far was to look at that in random ensemble. And basically, we saw the influence of these dipole-dipole interactions between the atoms. The problem is that the quantitative agreement was not great, and so the kind of ideas that the whole field has those days is trying to extend the kind of control that I showed you with the Rydberg, so basically create arrays, to the low-lying lines. I mean, it's much more demanding experimentally because you need to place the atom at distances which are on the order of the wavelength or sub-wavelength. Okay, but there are some ideas for doing that, and people have looked, many groups actually, have looked at this idea of, for example, taking an array of a two-dimensional array of atoms. And this two-dimensional array, if you have the right configuration and the right distance between the site, which is exactly on the order of the wavelength, which is switchable experimentally, you should be able to convert this plane and atom into a perfect atomic mirror. So you would have 100% reflection. People are also thinking of that in the context of optimizing clocks, because I mean, this dipole-dipole interaction is a real issue when it comes to the ultimate precision of a clock, because you interrogate the clock by sending the light, so those dipoles will interact, and that will introduce a bias in the outcome of the clock. So therefore, it's very important to kind of understand and maybe control this shift. Okay, so the kind of things that the field is going to, and not too much has been done experimentally so far, is trying to revisit this idea of light scattering in the context of driven dissipative many-body system. And for example, I mean, Igor has calculated the phase diagram, and so there are some approximations. It's either done in the case of small number of particles or in the mean field regime. And there are some predictions of the possibility of collective quantum jumps that are actually kind of locked by the existence of this dipole transition. So that's clearly something we would like to explore. And the second thing we would like to explore is the fact that because you've got interactions between the particles, these interactions are going to create non-linearities in the excitation spectrum of these many-body systems. So when you have a non-linearity in an excitation spectrum, you are led to non-harmonicity, lead to optical non-linearity. And the basic idea is that is it possible to use the non-linearities induced by the resonant dipole-dipole interaction in order to do something useful in quantum optics, like modifying the correlations on a light field that would impinge on this medium. So people have already started to look at that. It's difficult numerically. It's even more difficult to explore that experimentally, but that's something we'd like to look at. Okay, so in this light slide, this is the set of questions that I put here. And that we may discuss later. So basically, the kind of open question are a bit different between the Rydberg and the optical dipoles. I mean, for the Rydberg, basically, the bad dissipation, which is any imperfection of the experiment, is kind of a problem to observe the many-body effects sometimes you want to see. Maybe there is a way out and to try to use dissipation to help us preparing this many-body state. And for the optical dipoles, there are many open questions. There are actually both experimental and theoretical. So first, and can you have a strength of the non-linearity which is large enough to be able to see some useful quantum optics ideas? There is also this idea that was mentioned by Jacopo on Monday, which is, can we use the light that comes out of this many-body system and that should carry somehow the correlations between the atoms to characterize the system? I mean, the light is here and it has correlations. Okay, so with that, I want to thank you for your attention and sorry for having been long. So.
Thank you very much. Time for questions. Yes.
Yesterday afternoon, Peter Zoller mentioned in our discussion of, you know, why we're looking at open quantum systems, the concept that in addition to our unitary gates, that there's a set of dissipative gates that we should strive to achieve and use as building blocks for quantum computing. Can your dissipation, can your approaches to dissipation produce such, you know, local or conditional kinds of operations that are, that will help us achieve, you know, those elements of quantum computing?
I don't know. The basic answer is, I mean, here the kind of dissipation is actually not true. I mean, the dissipation comes from many different sources. In the case of the Rydberg, it's essentially the atoms are in free fly, so they slightly move. There are all the imperfections coming from the lasers. So at the moment, I don't really see that mapping exactly on what Peter talked about. In the case of this optical dipole, I mean, where the dissipation is intrinsically collective, maybe there is a way to harness it in order to create these gates. But I mean, yeah, once again, the basic idea is I don't know.
Yeah, it's the latter I was thinking about as a possibility. Uh-huh.
Thank you. So two quick questions about the talk. The first is probably something as a theorist I should already know, but what happens if you make the chain with one weak bond on one end and one strong bond on the other?
Yes, so but then you just have one edge state.
Okay, so it's just one edge state.
Yeah.
No particularly interesting
thing.
Well,
I don't think so,
there.
No. Okay. Nothing really special. So you confirm on Spitter, yeah.
The second is, you know, obviously well aware that characterizing noise in a many-body system by a couple of numbers is usually a very bad description. But what does your noise model look like for the many-Rydberg state, and what is sort of the rough? Is it, so you can get the tunneling terms about a megahertz. Right?
Yes.
And what is your but what does the sort of noise look like in the many Rydberg state, and what's the rough coherence time there?
Yeah, answering that in like 1 minute is a bit difficult because there are lots of things that actually. So what one of the students of Hans Peter does is that he takes any noise that we have in the experiment, any experimental imperfections, and put it on the simulation. So. So once again, the noise, it has many different sources, right? It's some kind of extra loss because you lose one of the atoms. It can be the fluctuations of the position of the atoms. They are always minimal, at least they are low enough that we are able to see the essence of the physics we are looking at. But I mean, we are kind of lucky that this, for example, this protection, this symmetry protection, is robust to the noise. So and that's exactly the kind of feature you want to look for, right? So I mean, I'm happy to discuss more about that, but there is really a long list of things we have to go through, so.
In the light scattering experiment, what you're measuring is scattering spectra, is that correct?
So what we measure is the amount of light that goes out of the system, so it's scattered by the system. So we had an elongated
angle
sample.
Resolved.
We can either measure the forward, the light which is forward in the scattered in the forward direction, or scattered on 90 degrees.
Oh, but you can't do the full range of angles,
but
or you could. Or?
It's a bit difficult. No, I mean we cannot really continuously monitor.
Yeah, because you were mentioning the question whether from the scattered light one can deduce properties of the correlations in the quantum many-body system. And I would have an idea how to do that if you have access to all the angles.
Yes.
But
okay, first, the first thing to say is that when we did the experiment so far, we were in the low light intensity limit. So basically, everything can be explained classically. So I don't expect any strong quantum correlations in the system. Of course, we want to go beyond that. The kind of thing we can also measure is either the amount of light or the statistic, the G2 function of the light, either scattered or transmitted. And but I mean, with like 360 degree
so you're not set.
I know we're not there, and we're never going to be there. I mean, it's just impossible to put a detector which is 4 pi steradian. So.
Yeah, but you could like scan.
No, this is yeah, sure, but experimentally this is hard to do.
Okay.
This.
Earlier this Nicholas, here you mentioned the non-uniformity of the dipole-dipole interaction in space. Earlier this year, you mentioned building up more and more symmetry to approach from the XY model toward, say, the Heisenberg interaction. I was curious about the progress in that direction.
In our lab, none. So basically, the idea is that indeed, naturally, you got this XY type of interaction, which is this flip-flop. There is one term that I've neglected and that does exist. This is also the van der Waals term. I mean, you can have like two spin up or two spin down would interact at the van der Waals. So actually what we really produce is an XXZ model. But the Z part, we took great care of minimizing it for the particular SSH experiment. You can work in another configuration where you try to basically make the thing almost symmetric, but it's never completely symmetric. So the full Heisenberg, at the moment, I don't think I have a way to provide it to you, if this is the question. We can approach it, but it would be an XXZ with the ratio which is 2, basically, between them.
So if I understand you correctly, you assume that these atoms sit at really fixed classical positions, which is, of course, only an approximation, right? I mean, they have some motional state.
Sorry, start again because I missed the beginning.
Oh, okay. So you assume that these atoms sit at fixed classical positions, and this is only an approximation. I mean, they sit in a trap, and they have some motional state. And in fact, this has quite some influence, can have some influence on the super radiant properties.
Okay.
So I don't know if you flashed briefly this discrepancy. Does this have an influence here?
So there are two different regimes. So the one on the Rydberg, to a very good approximation, we can assume that the atoms are pinned in space. I mean, of course, at some point they're going to move slightly during the time of the experiment, but we avoid this regime. So you can really, and for any, I mean, when we compare the theory with the experiment, it kind of works well to be in this approximation. For the light scattering, it's much more of a problem because the wavelength is much smaller. So the KR actually will build up very rapidly a phase factor, which is non-negligible with respect to pi. Any attempt we've done to model that seems to indicate that we cannot fully recover ever what we observe on the experiment. So the effect of the motion is not large enough to explain the discrepancy. So
maybe we should talk about it then.
Yes. Sure. I'd be happy because I mean that's really something which the whole field actually is has to fight. I mean we. Yeah. I hope that by just engineering that in tweezers again, we will kind of avoid this motion. But at the moment, done in random ensemble, yes, that's kind of a pain.
I mean, can you experimentally modify these traps to open them up and then see how it really changes the super radiance?
Well, it's not so easy because if you do that and you open the trap to cool down, for example, loveless motion, you also have much less density. So usually the effects are much harder to see then. So unfortunately, the range of parameters we have access to is reasonably constrained. And each time you want to check one effect, you basically kill everything you want to see. So, I'd be happy to discuss more about that because this is really something which, we haven't solved. So
thanks.
You were talking about putting dissipation in there, and you mentioned a driven dissipative steady state. I was wondering, how do you do the driven part of this? How do you put your energy?
Just the laser. So basically, I've been super fast, sorry about that. So for this kind of phase diagram that I showed here, so actually it's not our phase diagram, this is Igor's phase diagram. So basically, this is again the sigma plus sigma minus with this complex VDD that I had, plus the drive by the laser, plus a detuning. So basically, omega delta is the phase diagram of this ensemble of atoms that interact via the resonant dipole-dipole interaction, driven by a laser which has an amplitude or strength of the field omega, and which is detuned with respect to delta, by delta with respect to the transition.
Excuse me, you say laser, can you translate this to a term in the Hamiltonian for me?
Sure. So basically, the Hamiltonian would be this VDD, sigma plus sigma minus plus summation conjugate, you would have a sum of sigma xi plus you would have some h bar delta, the sum of sigma z term. Okay, so the omega and delta here are the omega and delta that are here. So this is, and classically, this is very simple. I mean, this is just an ensemble of atoms which is dense enough that the atoms would interact when they are polarized. And you send the light is detuned with respect to the atomic transition. So this is omega, and this is delta. And you would have like ground state, excited state, and optical transition. Okay, and so that's the phase diagram. So what is plotted here is the average population. So this is the average of sigma z. So I don't know if it helps.
So along the same lines as what Daniel was asking, is it possible if you have the quantized center of mass motion that you can prepare, let's say, either a symmetric or an anti-symmetric motional superposition and then change the overall symmetry properties of the state?
So I'm not completely sure I understand the question. The kind of experiment we've done, on the optical transition, it's very hard because, the distance between the atoms to see this has to be 100 nanometer. On the Rydberg, we've done it. So basically, you can prepare the symmetric up-down plus down-up or up-down minus down-up and switch from one to another one just by adding a laser, which would induce a local shift on one of the two atoms. So that we've done, yes.
Right.
But this is not to do with the motion. So.
But in terms of the quantized center of mass, so if I include that into consideration as a separate degree of freedom.
Okay. So I don't know. Everything we do from the point of view of the center of mass is classical. The atoms are hot enough that you can think of them as billiard balls. So we've never looked at the quantization in this regime. And of course, if we try to cool them in the ground state, which we are certainly trying to do, this will become something we have to look at. So.
Okay, so is there some remaining urgent question? We are perfect in time. If not, then let's thank Anton again.